Hello, and welcome to Different Bits, coming at you live from the Mission District of San Francisco on Enemy Combatant Radio, enemycombatantradio.net on the web, 104.1 in the Mission, and various other air-friendly locations in San Francisco, and also in the East Bay. Penny's here in the studio with me today.
Hello.
We have a pre-recorded interview coming up for you tonight with Krista Sommerer, who is an Austrian new media artist, really interesting lady, who would have loved to be live, but time differences made that impossible. So she is going to talk about her project Mobile Feelings, and also Artificial Life, and a book she worked on called Art at Science. Really interesting book, which you can get at Amazon.com, but you just have to look for Art Science because the at sign doesn't show up. And so that is going up for you right now. You were just listening to a track by Bernard Parmigiani on Phase Doors. And that about does it. I don't know. Did you have anything you wanted to say, Penny? Anything to share with our listeners?
Definitely check out the SF International Film Festival. It's still going
on
until the 5th, I believe, at the Kabuki and the Castro Theater, and I think in the East Bay as well, in a few venues.
Anything you know of that you are especially interested in seeing at the film festival?
I just saw Werner Herzog's newest movie. I got there late, so I feel like I can't give a review of it. But
is it the incident at Loch Ness? Or
no, it's
else.
Actually one he directed. I guess Incident at Loch Ness he just appeared in. I didn't actually see that. But
yeah, he sort of, I don't know.
Did you see
Incident? I did. It's a bit of a twisted storyline. Like, it sort of gives you the impression that he directed it. I'll leave it at that.
That's odd, because I know he actually didn't, but I don't really know.
The whole thing is sort of a big deception.
Oh, okay.
It's a fun deception, though.
That sounds like something he'd be interested in being in on, definitely.
So which one did you say?
Gosh, let me see. I got there about 20 minutes late, so I don't have... Sorry, it was The White Diamond.
And you want to give us a quick review of it?
It was just about this man who was obsessed with going up in some kind of hot air balloon over the waterfalls in South America.
I am personally a big fan of hot air balloons.
So I don't know. I don't feel like I can do it justice because I got there about 20 minutes late and I feel like I need to see the film again to be able to give a full review. But it's definitely interesting.
Anything coming up you're looking forward to?
Gosh.
It's okay if there isn't.
I'm a bad representative of this film festival because I work too much to have been... Well, Ingmar Bergman had a new film as well that I didn't get to see, but that sounded interesting, and hopefully it will be shown again.
All right. Is that it?
I think that's all I have to say on the subject.
There's a sheet of paper that is gone now, but...
Uh-oh. All right. Well, that is great. Thank you so much, Penny, for reminding us about the San Francisco International Film Festival. And I guess now we will kick it over to Krista. All right. After the interview with Krista, you will listen to Neural Synthesis Number 8 by David Tudor. And that will do it for this week. Tune in next week. We're going to interview Karen Marcello, the originator of Dorkbot in San Francisco. And that should be a lot of fun. She'll be live in the studio. Okay. Stay tuned.
We're joined today by new media artist Krista Sommerer. She's joining us remotely from Austria. Hello, Krista.
Yes, hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Thank you. Fine.
Would you care to introduce yourself and give us a sense of your background?
Yes, my name is Krista Sommerer. I work since around 15 years together with a French artist, Laurent Mignonneau, in the area of interactive computer installation. We have met in Frankfurt, Germany, where we both studied at the Postgraduate Institute for New Media in Frankfurt. And then we went on to go to Chicago, at where we worked at the NCSA, National Center for Supercomputing Application, for 1 year. And from there, we went to Japan for 10 years to work firstly at the ATR Advanced Telecommunication Research Center in Kyoto, and then taught at the university in Gifu, the YAMAS International Institute of Advanced Media Art and Science. And we just now moved back to Linz, Austria, where we both teach at the University of Art and Design in the area of interface design.
So you guys have been collaborating for a very long time.
Yes, since 91, basically.
And can you describe your collaboration a little bit for us?
Yeah, when it comes to like doing concepts, Laurent and me work together. We like mostly the works grow out of previous works. So there's a lot of collaboration on developing the concepts and the technical and also theoretical work behind it. When it comes to like management, writing papers and so on, that's my part of the job. And Laurent is very strongly involved in the technical development of the works. But we also sometimes collaborate with other people, especially when we worked at the ATR Research Center. We worked with other people or also sometimes work with corporations and so on.
Could you start off by telling us about your project, Mobile Feelings?
Yes, Mobile Feelings is an interactive kind of communication work where users hold kind of strange objects that look either like kind of eggs or like gourds, like pumpkins. And when the users hold these objects, they can exchange their heartbeat with each other. And by holding this in your hand, the pulse, your own pulse, is being captured by a pulse sensor and sent via wireless communication network to the other user's object, and the user can feel the other user's heartbeat in his hand. This is achieved through a kind of actuator that's integrated in this object that's moving and pulsing, and it gives you the very strong sensation of having the other person's heart in your hand. It's a kind of very intimate and kind of almost very, very private way of communicating with each other. And in addition to exchanging heartbeats, people can also send their breath or breathing to the other person. By blowing into this object, you transmit your own breath to the other person, and the other person perceives this breath of the other user through a small microventilator that's blowing air into his or her face. So it's kind of very intimate and very subtle communication that people have, like kind of nonverbal communication that's actually very, very direct and very, yeah, feels very private.
Where did the idea for the project come from?
Well, it's a kind of continuation of an idea of communicating with each other, maybe through sort of non-verbal means. And another sort of idea comes from this like observation that people in the kind of constant, being constantly connected to each other, a lot of privacy is also being lost. So it's a kind of almost like a test or a kind of setting to test whether how far people would go and, you know, how the sort of last corners of privacy that's actually like physical touch or exchanging or touching each other, how you could kind of extend that through mobile communications and see what happens when you kind of touch each other over distance.
Could you talk a little more about the physical form of the objects?
There are different iterations. The first version is actually a gourd, like a real kind of vegetable. And inside we integrated all the technology. There's different sensors inside, actuators, and the Bluetooth communication unit. But the actual object itself is like very perishable. So it just lasts for a few days. Then it starts to rot. And in the second version, we made it like without the gourd, and you hold like egg-shaped objects. And in the third version, we have it now with a gourd, but that's dried up, so that kind of keeps for a long time. And the reason why we use this organic vegetable or fruit is to kind of create a very bizarre way of a kind of technological object and kind of challenge the metaphor of, you know, telecommunication devices that are usually very sleek and very sort of modern-looking. We wanted to break that and bring the organic into it and see how you could combine this technology with something very organic.
The photos online are sort of heighten that distinction maybe with the images of people sitting in the very space-age looking chairs holding these sort of alien life form looking.
Yes. There is also this whole setting around it is kind of important because the idea was to create a kind of half private and half public space. So in the first version, we are using these bubble chairs where people sit inside. They're still being observed by other people, but they at the same time have a very kind of private feeling of being in that kind of bubble space and still being open to kind of communicate with others. And one observation we did when we showed the system the first time is that when you actually concentrate only on the feeling of touch and like perceiving someone else's heartbeat, it somehow shuts down the other senses, or you have to shut down the other senses in order to be able to concentrate on the sense of touch. Because the kind of visual or audio sense is so strong that often it takes special concentration to actually concentrate on your haptic feelings. And these chairs seem to be very good for doing that because they kind of let you close your other senses down or sort of at least temporarily, you know, dim them down to be able to concentrate more on the sensation of that touch.
What is it like just experiencing all of these different people's heartbeats?
It's very weird. At the beginning, it's quite embarrassing because often, you know, I mean, it's not very common to touch other people in, like, real life. Mm-hmm. And then also feeling someone's heartbeat in your hand is kind of a sometimes intimidating and sometimes a little bit sexy or a little bit kind of erotic, mm-hmm. depending on who the other person is, if you like him or her. So it's kind of a strange, intimate feeling. And then after a while, after you sort of overcome the first embarrassment, it becomes actually very comforting. And it's sometimes almost sad when it's finished because it's kind of a kind of, comforting feeling to have this pulsing, lifelike motion in your hand. And another observation we could do is that when you do this with several people, that each person seems to have his or her own kind of individual heartbeat. So there's kind of differences you can make between people by just actually not looking at them, but just feeling them. And often the way people look you cannot conclude from the way people look on what kind of heartbeat they have. That's also sometimes very funny. Even if you see a very strong, big man, mm-hmm. and you would expect this very strong, heavy heartbeat, then sometimes this person has a very fast and very light and very nervous kind of heartbeat. So it's kind of strange to see these discrepancies between how people look and what their heartbeat actually is.
Yeah, that does sound really interesting.
I'm not sure. There must be some studies, but I mean, we didn't do it in a sort of scientific way, but
right. Like
just by having tried it with many people, I see there's actually really a lot of differences between people.
In your description of the project, you discuss the idea of getting art off the walls and into people's lives. Could you talk a little bit about this idea and why it's important to you?
Yeah, I think especially with interactive artworks, I mean, that started sort of in the late 80s, artists like us and others were kind of interested to create works that constantly change, evolve, adapt to the environment, and would be actually not fixed, but a kind of process, like art as a process. And these works also need people to really function, so people actually make the works, and you just provide the framework. Mm-hmm. And in this sort of more earlier works, a lot of the works have been screen-based in a sort of mostly dark space or darkened space settings. And we recently became interested to maybe extend that and bring these works more into like daily life situations. And I think this mobile filling project is a step into that direction to test how far can you bring an object that's a kind of in between an art object and maybe a gadget into daily life situations and see how much people would react to this. And if the concepts that you want to convey still work in those more sort of open space settings.
But despite the goal of the mobile feelings is still a gallery piece. Have you guys thought at all about how you might implement sort of pushing it out? It's not a gallery piece, it's a museum piece, it's an installation indoors. I'm just wondering sort of how you might imagine it escaping the walls.
Well, I think it works best in a setting that's half private and half open and half public, so kind of lounge situation. But it does need, I mean, if you just carry these objects with you and just hand it to people, then, you know, they don't concentrate enough to actually look at them and feel it. So you need some kind of setting that lets people concentrate on you know, really perceiving each other's touch and, you know, start to think about it. So I think this situation of where you have, like, some really comfortable, interesting-looking chairs in a kind of nice half-open space works actually pretty well. But another test we are going to do is to see if we minimize or miniaturize these objects and people just walk around with them, maybe in a kind of performance setting or so. And then just people connect to each other and just, you know, beam each other their heartbeat and see what happens. I think that would be also an interesting situation.
Yeah, definitely.
Performance. To, like, really integrate it into daily life and see how people would actually use them as a kind of flirting tool, maybe. You know, kind of, you could imagine you have this in your pocket, but the other person doesn't know you have one of these mobile feelings objects. And then you send your heartbeat to the person because you think he or she looks interesting. And when you walk by, this person can perceive you somehow. So it could be a kind of
a strange
funny way of
flirtation.
Maybe
method.
Even intrusive. I don't know. It depends how it's done. But a kind of funny way of communicating with each other without speaking.
Right.
Or without even looking.
No, that is interesting. So is the piece complete or are you guys still actively developing it?
It's still in process. I think it's going to have a few more, you know, upgrades. And especially the breathing sensors with the odor. I think we are going to work on that too.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, and miniaturization and the kind of ad hoc networking between the devices. So I think that's the next steps we want to do.
What are you thinking about as far as odor?
Well, it would be also interesting, except of just, you know, breathing at each other, but also kind of sending different smells to the other person.
Definitely.
Like, you know, good smells, bad smells, perfume, I don't know, bad smell in your mouth, maybe sending it to the other person could be kind of interesting.
Definitely. I mean, it would be amazing if you could do some sort of smell capture.
Yes, yes. Only problem is this is kind of like technology that's bigger, so it's to put that into these tiny objects is maybe quite difficult, at least at this stage.
Right. That's cool. Thank you. So where can we see this? in the United States?
Well, Mobile Feelings is going to be in the U.S. pretty soon in June at the Next Fest, which is organized by Wired Magazine. And it's in Chicago, I think around June 20.
All right. That sounds great. Well, I know I'm going to try to be there.
Yeah, it should be fun.
A number of your artworks have dealt with the idea of different interfaces to information contained on the internet. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what it is about interaction with information that intrigues you.
Yeah, this came out of the kind of search for complexity. In our very early works, we worked with genetic algorithms and kind of genetic generation of images, especially in the works of Awolf and Life Species or Phototropy. These are all works we did using genetic-based graphics, where you would, where the user, through his interaction, would always generate new results, and then the system itself also proposed new solutions, like new mutations and kind of new genetic outcomes or offspring. And after doing a few of these works with genetic algorithms, we became interested to actually use the internet as a huge database of complex imagery that's constantly changing and let people interact with the database. And works we did in these directions are called, for example, Riding the Net. It's a multimodal interface where two users sit opposite of each other, and there's a kind of screen on the wall, interactive screen. And when the users talk into the microphones, the conversation is being captured through a speech recognition system, live, and every word that they say is kind of being used as a keyword to download images from the internet. So if you talk, for example, I don't know, about your last trip to Spain, the system, you know, understands Spain and maybe Madrid, and then pulls up images of Spain and Madrid. And when the two users then, you know, talk maybe about another city, he says, you know, I've been to, I don't know, Chicago, then, you know, images of Chicago pull up. So in a way, this is becoming a kind of conversation, you know, enhancement tool, because by talking to each other, the system pulls up these images, and then the images on screen give you, again, ideas of new topics you could talk about. So it becomes almost like a brainstorming tool to, you know, like support your discussion. And it's actually quite fun if you do that for a while, because you kind of come from one topic to the other, and the images that appear on screen are often sometimes also very unexpected, because even if the system understands correctly what you said, there are so many images on the internet for every, you know, keyword that you say, that it's just incredibly rich, a rich database of images and sounds.
So these projects are really more about sort of an experience of information as opposed to a tool for sifting through information.
Yes, yes. It's not really a useful tool in the sense that you find exactly what you're looking for. It's more like almost like watching television, but in a more interactive way. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know exactly what you're looking for, but you kind of have certain ideas, and then the system is proposing stuff, and that maybe leads you to other topics. So it's kind of very entertaining, actually, to kind of just navigate through the web in this very intuitive way. And what I forgot to mention is you can actually also, if you find something interesting on screen, you know, these images keep floating by, and if you find something interesting, you can also hold that image with your hand on the screen and look at it in more detail and eventually find out where the image came from and so on. But in general, it's much more as a kind of, you know, entertaining way to browse through the internet in a very sort of simple and non-keyboard-based way.
Do you see the internet continuing to move in a more entertainment-oriented direction, and you know, a little bit more away from an purely information-oriented search?
Yeah, I don't know so many other systems in that sense, but I could imagine, yes, that people, you know, maybe get sooner or later tired of that keyboard interface. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, kind of very restrictive because, I mean, there's only like a certain amount of information you have on each web page. And then you have to click an awful lot in order to, you know, see right. much. So it's actually very time consuming and you know, tiring for the eye sometimes. Mm-hmm. So if you would make that much more multimodal and, you know, sort of easy to use, and even my mom or my grandma would maybe
right.
be able to use it if she doesn't want to type something, I think that could be quite successful.
Yeah, that is interesting. I'm wondering, you know, there's sort of a, well, right now it seems like a number of websites and, you know, various places on the internet are sort of trying to push your experience of their web page in some sort of more creative direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes if that's what you're looking for, that can be sometimes kind of interesting, but a lot of times it can be really annoying, you know.
It takes a lot of time. I mean, browsing the net takes a lot of time. And I mean, in most cases you find what you need, but sometimes you just want to, you know, enjoy all this richness of images mm. and information that's out there without, I mean, it's like shopping in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that you actually find what you're looking for. Like if I go shopping, you know, I know, okay, I would like a red pullover with some kind of, you know, blue stripes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go to the shop and you find a lot of other things. And then usually you come home and buy other things. I mean, you didn't find that red pullover, right. but it doesn't matter anymore because you found actually more interesting stuff. And I think that's the way the internet should be, you know. Like, just see the richness of it and just discover stuff by chance.
Right, following tangents, definitely. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious where you see our internet experience going in, say, the next 10 years.
The internet experience?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a difficult question. I mean, I imagine that a lot of things would become like, you know, sort of mixed reality, and, you know, it will happen. I mean, it already happens on your PDA and on your mobile phone, mm-hmm. and it will happen on, you know, kind of mixed reality systems. And
it definitely seems
information
to be.
Can be also in 3D, like you have all these GPS-based data that, you know, float around you, and you go shopping and you get all this information about, you know, the local shop onto your PDA and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
increasingly dispersed
to,
into
to say that as an artist, you know, there's lots of people working on that right now,
mm-hmm.
making that a reality, kind of, you know, intelligent environments, things like that.
So moving back in time, perhaps a little bit, I'd like to hear about your work with Artificial Life.
Yeah, this was, we started to work with A-Life around 92, 93, coming from, the idea came from the very first work which we did, which was interactive plant growing. That was a work where people can touch real plants to create artificial plants on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And from getting this data of the people's touch and touch and the connection to the real plants, we found out that actually it's very interesting for people to create something by themselves and something unique that the other person didn't create. So that gave us the idea of working with genetic algorithms, because they're very useful to create a big variety of image outputs. And in 93, I believe, there was Ars Electronica in Linz, the big festival here,
mm-hmm.
Was dealing with artificial life and genetic art. And we met Tom Ray at that time. He's quite famous in the area mm-hmm. of artificial life, and he was the inventor of the Tiara system. And we started to work with him on the Evolved system, our own Evolved system, where people can draw shapes with their fingers, and then these shapes somehow become alive as 3D creatures that swim in a water-filled glass pool.
Mm.
And those creatures are quite aggressive. They attack each other, they try to kill each other and eat each other's energy. And if they succeed, they would also be able to reproduce and make new creatures and have children. So it was a kind of small evolutionary system that followed the internal, you know, genetic principles, mm-hmm. but also was open to the interaction with people. So when people were drawing them, they had an input on how these creatures behaved, on their fitness, and also people could, with their hand in the water, protect the creatures or disturb them or even kill them. So it was a kind of a, or is actually a very interactive system in all ways.
Are you still still working with artificial life at all?
Right now, actually not directly. No, we did quite a few works with artificial life, but we might go back to it again, because recently we did actually already one work loosely dealing with nanotechnologies. Mm-hmm. And I could imagine that in the future we might combine this new interest in nanotechnology with genetic algorithms again.
Mm, definitely. Yeah, that sounds interesting. In your book, Art at Science, you discuss the question of how new technologies affect the role of art and the function of the artist. Can mm-hmm. you discuss the synthesis of art and technology in your own work?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why do you work with new technology as opposed to, say, paint?
Well, I think it's maybe somehow in a way biographical. My background is from biology. I originally studied botany and anthropology and actually started to work on a PhD on electron microscopy, and then went into the arts, did this kind of modern sculpture, but was always trying to find a way back into the sciences, mm-hmm. especially biology. And that was not really possible when I studied, because there was, at least in Austria, a very rigid system in the university that you could either go to art university or to science university, and there was no way to mix the both. And later, when I went to Frankfurt, that was the first time when I actually discovered this whole area of, you know, computer graphics and mm-hmm. people like Louis Beck and, you know, Dan Sandine and Donna Cox and all these people that actually worked with kind of scientific visualization that were often also very artistic. And generally speaking, I think it's kind of interesting to be between chairs,
right.
Like to, you know, go into a field that you don't know yet and get inspired to import some principle from that field that's maybe totally unrelated into your own field. And right now, I think that's happening to us again with nanotechnologies, because there's all these new materials and all these new principles that people find in chemistry and physics, or, you know, even in ethics, you know, dealing with nanotechnologies from an ethical point of view, that I find very inspiring to bring into our own field, which is maybe more media art.
Is this idea of bringing art and new technology together new, or is this something you see a sort of long historical precedent for?
Yeah, I think there's a whole history, you know, like Bauhaus and the constructivism and so on. So it's not really new. What is maybe new that now it's becoming more and more mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember about 10, 15 years ago, there were very few people. And I think the book Art and Science somehow brought together, maybe not all, but a few of the key people from that field who were at that time still kind of quite, you know, not exactly outsiders, but, you know, dreamers or people that were sort of doing that because of mm-hmm. this was their own interest. But now we see more and more universities actually establishing these interdisciplinary institutes, where it's quite common that the chemist is working with the artist and the artist is working with the philosopher and the key people from that field who were at that time still kind of quite, you know, not exactly outsiders, but, you know, dreamers or people that were sort of doing that because of this was their own interest. But now we see more and more universities actually establishing these interdisciplinary institutes where it's quite common that the chemist is working with the artist and the artist is working with the philosopher and the computer scientist is maybe working with the, you name it, I don't know, a totally different field. So I think this whole idea of bringing different disciplines together is becoming very normal right
now.
It is,
yes.
Which is actually a very good trend, but sometimes also difficult. I think it's not always successful to mix totally different fields together. It really depends on the case, but I think it's definitely worth trying to kind of change more. But I think that's anyway better in the US. In your universities, you have more interchange between the disciplines. But in Europe, that's still, I think there still needs to be some work being done to break those, to break the boundaries between disciplines.
Yeah, I would say in the past couple of years, we've just had an explosion of interdisciplinary work, you know.
Yeah, which is really great. I mean, that's wonderful. That didn't happen like 10 years ago.
Yeah, do you have any thoughts on why it suddenly seems to be exploding the way it is?
I have no idea, but I guess it must be politics. But maybe there were some kind of successful examples of, you know, people coming from different backgrounds and then, you know, just throwing things together and something new emerges. I mean, it's like emergence, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You bring different things together and just, you know, let it boil, and then eventually something new emerges from this. So I guess it works.
For the artist, too, I mean, it's also sort of a way of liberating the artist from this sort of historical concept we have that, you know, a painter works in paint and paints, you know, sort of very similar things throughout their entire life. This sort of interdisciplinary work seems to be allowing artists to explore many different ideas and ways of working throughout a career.
That's right, yes. I mean, and also it's not anymore, you know, I think when I studied, my professor always told me, you know, the artist is only working for himself and he doesn't have to care about the other people.
Mm-hmm.
Just do your own work and just make it and listen to your internal feeling and then it will be all fine. But I think art is not anymore like this. You are not disconnected from the rest of the world. And I mean, even society needs artists because there's a certain kind of maybe visual or intuitive knowledge that artists have that maybe in the sciences is not so, not being trained so much. So mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of mutual benefits artists and scientists can have from each other. And often the old distinction of I'm an artist or I'm a scientist or I'm an engineer
right.
is not even so relevant anymore, because these days artists are also becoming more like scientists or engineers or even researchers.
Definitely.
And, you know, by having all these institutions that offer like more scientific training for artists or more art-based or at least art courses in the sciences. I think that's this old distinction of saying I'm an artist or I'm a scientist is becoming irrelevant.
Definitely. It's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you consider yourself a researcher or a scientist as well as an artist personally?
Well, kind of research artist or artist researcher. I couldn't decide yet if I'm more like artist researcher or research artist, but maybe more artist researcher, because at the end, really, I'm more interested in a kind of artistic output than only the paper output right. or a kind of actual real product.
Something physical.
Mm-hmm.
So what's coming up in the future?
Well, right now we are working on on a nanotechnology group together with Leonardo Journal, MIT Press, and trying to explore, field of nanotechnology and see how artists, I mean, there's very few artists right now working with this. And I find it quite interesting to see what kind of new materials or what kind of new technologies are in there and see how that can lead to maybe the next, not digital, but the next creative revolution for artists as it was the digital technologies maybe like 10, 15 years ago.
Well, thank you so much, Krista.
I thank you for the nice interview. I just would like to invite everybody who is in the US and listens to this to come maybe to the next Ars Electronica, which is happening again in Linz in September this year.
great. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, and have a nice evening.
You too. Thank you, Krista. Mm-hmm. And Krista's website, which I was not quite communicating effectively there, her website is www.iamas.ac.jp /Krista.
Thank you.